Atención, noticia de última hora. Chucky Town se encuentra en su tierra. Chocó.
After 5 years of grassroots organizing against the U.S. Free Trade Agreement with Colombia, the U.S. Congress passed the Colombia FTA on October 12, 2011. Tonight on Circle A Radio, our guest is Carlos Cruz. He works with Witness for Peace in Colombia. Stay tuned.
My name is Carlos Cruz, and I'm working with Witness for Peace in Colombia, and we are a Latin American solidarity organization here. And what we do is track the impacts of U.S. foreign policy and multinational corporations here in Colombia and work with those sectors of affected Colombian society, and we bring them to the U.S. audiences who are concerned and want to do something about it.
I was thinking that we would start out with the fact that the Colombia Free Trade Agreement just passed. If you could talk about the impact of that.
Well, it depends. There's going to be a lot of impacts in a lot of different sectors. Basically, it's going to aggravate the situation here, Colombia, within land displacement, human rights, labor disputes, labor abuses. So it depends on what sector you want to concentrate on. For example, the agricultural sector is going to be really affected. Maybe 2 months ago, I went on a speaker's tour with someone from Cajibio in Cauca, the central part of the country. And it's with a small-scale farmers movement. Monsanto is basically coming into Colombia and is going to start with their privatization of seeds. And the Colombian government offers no technical assistance, no subsidies. So they're up against U.S. grains and U.S. agricultural food that is subsidized and Monsanto. So there's going to be a lot of small-scale farmers being affected.
Before the FTA passed, was Monsanto already in Colombia, or has that specifically changed the scope of the ability for multinationals to operate there?
Well, in order for the FTA to pass, the U.S. Demanded Colombia to agree with no agricultural or technological agricultural restrictions, which basically means in order for the FTA to pass, Monsanto should be able to come in. Whereas before, I think Colombia had some regulations or restrictions for Monsanto to come in, but with the FTA, they're free to operate now.
Can you talk about some of the other local struggles in Colombia?
Well, the sugarcane cutters, they have been on trial since 2008. They are mostly Afro-Colombian. They work in 90 to 100 degree heat every single day. And cane, sugar cane, is grown 4 times a year, so it's all year round work. And a lot of them have a lot of back injuries, carpal tunnel. They receive no medical attention. They have to pay their transportation costs to get there, their own lunch. They're paid very, very little. I think they're paid like $500 a month or less. So they organized a strike for better labor conditions. And after the strike, they were accused of terrorism, sabotage. 8 of them have been on trial since 2008, not knowing if they're going to go to jail or face any other criminal charges for more since 2008, basically. And what we've been doing with them, we've been working with some delegates who came on a labor delegation trying to kind of ask for justice and due process of law and a fast and speedy trial. But the ingenuos, the sugar mills, are very, very powerful in Cali. They belong to landholding families who've been around for decades or maybe centuries. And they own the land, the labor, and the political and judicial systems. So They're fighting against an entrenched political and economic interest. Yeah, and the GM workers, there's a group of about 50 to 56 General Motors workers. They were working there for 8 to 10 years in an assembly plant in the south of Bogota. And their labor conditions are also horrible. They're pressured into working really fast and in very awkward body positions. So they were getting injured left and right. And then once that GM got a hold of their medical records, which they're not supposed to have, your employer is not supposed to have your private medical information, they were all fired so GM wouldn't have to give out any compensation or medical treatments. So after they got fired, they started an organization, and they've been camped out of the U.S. Embassy for about probably 130 days now. And they've been pretty successful with their really grassroots campaign. They've met with two senators, the ambassador, the labor attaché, they've gotten attention from WOLA, the Washington Office of Latin America, and they've gotten some national attention. But they haven't been publicized because Semana, a weekly magazine, was going to publish an article about their labor situation and exploitation. But they wouldn't publish it because General Motors has publicity spots in the magazine. So their truth couldn't be revealed to the whole Colombian society because it conflicted with political economic interests. And they were also interviewed with several spots on TV, Colombian TV, and it wasn't aired because those channels also have publicity spots with General Motors. So when General Motors hears that they're going to, broadcast this, they basically say, if you broadcast it, we'll pull out our funding from our publicity spots in your channels. Sure. And they've been basically working with a lot of international attention. And so a couple delegates are trying to get the United Auto Workers from the U.S. to kind of be in solidarity with them because they face a lot of obstacles here, especially in the media and funding. They're basically running a grassroots campaign from their own pockets. All of them have had surgery left and right. Some of them are getting their homes repossessed because they don't have work, and they're running this campaign out of their pockets trying to get some justice. It's been very difficult because the inspectors that fired them, the inspectors that were also called on by the Labor Action Plan back in April, are the ones who fired them, even though it was legal to fire them.
So how is the solidarity from the U.S. As far as the labor movement goes and the auto workers?
Some of the former delegates that just came in November, they're trying to get the automotive sector from the U.S. to stand with the GM workers here. They've gotten a couple of articles on Washington Office in Latin America, especially regarding labor rights in Colombia, the automotive workers here. But they're also going to be affected by another pending free trade agreement between Colombia and South Korea. South Korea produces 11 times more cars than all of Colombia's automotive plants put together. And once they sign that free trade deal, I think the automotive industry in Colombia will be at risk.
What can folks in the U.S. do to support workers and farmers in Colombia?
Like a lot of people in Colombia think that consumerism is a political act. One thing to do is boycott all Monsanto products, big corporation products, mass consumerism, and stop giving, money to all these multinational corporations that are operating in the U.S. and in all over the world, and especially in Colombia. There is a lot of things to do. Labor union leaders and labor union members are still being killed in Colombia. And I think the U.S. citizens have more of a leverage since Colombia and the U.S. have so many bilateral agreements now that the U.S. citizenry, active citizenry, can pressure Colombia into fulfilling the labor regulations, the labor action plan, human rights agreements, indigenous people's rights, Afro-Colombian rights, because they're more and more tied, and it doesn't make sense if the U.S. is tied to Colombia and Colombia's killing, labor leaders, social activists, human rights defenders left and right. So there's a lot of work to be done.
Carlos, I don't think a lot of us in the U.S. necessarily understand the severity of what's happened with the history of the Civil War and paramilitaries killing folks who are standing up for their rights and their communities. Can you give us a background on Colombia and the Civil War?
Like Colombia, like most Latin American countries, have a very entrenched political class that stems back centuries. They own all the political, economic, and social means of production. The FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, were started in 1963 because in 1949, there was a liberal leader called Jorge Gaitán who was murdered in Bogotá, and he wanted land reform, basically. And he was murdered, which set off a time period called La Violencia, the violence, where a lot of campesinos, small-scale farmers, were killed because they wanted land. So a lot of intellectuals and farmers went off to the countryside and funded kind of like independent republics. They were also started by the Colombian Communist Party. And so the Colombian government, along with the U.S., bombed one of these independent republics, which set off a lot of angst amongst this movement. And in 1963, that's where the Colombian Revolutionary Armed Forces are formed, the FARC. Now they've become, they're considered a terrorist organization by the EU and by the U.S. They're about 8,000 to 9,000 strong. They're all over the country mostly. And they finance themselves through narco-trafficking, and they are the hemisphere's longest insurgency or terrorism group to date. Their ideology is mostly Marxist, Leninist. They want to overthrow the state, which has made their ideology or their movement back in the 20th century a political target. We're talking about the Cold War. The United States is not interested in having communism in the hemisphere. So the United States with the Colombian military joined forces and indirectly or directly formed paramilitary groups, which work in conjunction with the military but not legally binded with the military. They work on the same goals. And Colombian history has been shown to have helicopter support by the Colombian military, and then paramilitaries commit massacres back in 2000, back in 2001. It's been proven that the Colombian military works with paramilitary groups. And the Colombian military receives billions of dollars from the U.S. military assistance. Since 2000, they've received over $7 billion. So indirectly, the U.S. is funding paramilitary death squads who are killing small-scale farmers who oppose the neoliberal project, who oppose being dispossessed of their lands to make room for multinational corporations, which the free trade agreement is aggravating. The free trade agreement wants monocrops. They want African palm oil. They want to grow agrofuels. They want to fuel their jets, their tanks. So Colombia is feeding the world market with monocrops, with oil, or Colombia exports oil to the United States. And one of the biggest reasons why Plan Colombia, the $7 billion military aid assistance to Colombia was passed, is because Occidental Petroleum from California has a pipeline from the Amazon to the coast. And the insurgency, the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, were blowing it up an average of like 250 times a year. So Occidental Petroleum lobbies the U.S. Congress in order to pass Plan Colombia so their investments in Colombia would be protected. So U.S. taxpayers are subsidizing the security and the protection of a U.S. Multinational here in Colombia, with most of the people not knowing it back in the United States.
Yeah, no, I didn't know that. That was part of what was behind Plan Colombia, which is why these specific stories are so useful for us in the U.S. I also was wondering, I recently saw a documentary called The Red Dance, which is about a period in the 1980s in Colombia where the Union Patriotica, the Patriotic Union Party, came up. Yeah. And can you talk a little bit about that?
So the Union Patriotica was a political party started from the political wing of the left-wing insurgency, the FARC. They were the wing that was, you know, not violent, because the armed conflict in Colombia has not been solved because there hasn't been political negotiation to it. It's happened before with the M-19. They've demobilized. Now the mayor of Bogota, a city of 8 million people, used to be a left-wing insurgent member of the M-19 back in the 80s and 90s. And there hasn't been a political dialogue or solution to the armed conflict now. So the Unión Patriótica could have been a solution back in the day if the Colombian state did not murder over 3,000 of its members. It was a political genocide, which arms the conflict, because people say, okay, well, they're going to kill us if we have a political party with no arms or weapons. Why should we disarm? Why should we disband? Why should we demobilize? But one of the Congress members, or sorry, senators, who was murdered, his last name is Cepeda. His son is a senator now in Colombia. His name is Iván Cepeda. He's with the movement of victims of state crime, and it's been shown that the Colombian state murdered all these people, and there's been no justice, there's been no truth, there's been no historical memory, and most of all, there's been no sanctions against the Colombian state.
I just saw a newspaper article, I guess it was from this past month, that a law had been passed called the Law of the Victims. Does it have anything behind it that's going to support people who have lost family members to state violence and paramilitaries?
Well, the FARC, the Revolutionary Forces, they have a very specific political agenda. One of them has been, throughout the decades, the restitution of land and compensation of victims against the armed conflict that's been happening in Colombia. So the Colombian government, in order to delegitimize the FARC, has implemented a lot of their political requests. So the victims law, which seeks to give back land to small farmers who were dispossessed of that land because of the conflict, it sounds very good, and it's a post-conflict solution. But the problem is the country is in conflict. It's not in post-conflict. And the Colombian governments, these past two, Álvaro Uribe, which lasted for 8 years, and Juan Manuel Santos, who just took power in 2008, they're following a very neoliberal agenda. So the lands that these people are getting are for the cultivation of monocrops like African palm oil. And crops that don't feed the Colombian population, that aren't typically grown in Colombia. So these crops and the land that they're getting are for exportation to the world market to feed U.S. and Europe for the free trade agreement.
Wow. No, yeah, again,
and
what's
people don't know how to cultivate these foreign crops, and then they're going to have, you know, they're going to be indebted, and they're going to have to sell their land back to a multinational corporation.
Wow, that's really pretty diabolical that that's behind this law that is being put forth, as you said, to delegitimize what people are really asking for, the demands that have kept this conflict going.
And actually, once people get their land back and they need technical assistance, which USAID from the U.S. Embassy here gives out, it's technical assistance towards monocropping. Again, reinforcing the idea that Colombia needs to feed the world market with monocrops for fuels or any other things. And the thing is going to be that with the free trade agreement, like in Mexico and Canada, the NAFTA, a lot of small-scale farmers lost a lot of their land because Mexico had to rewrite its constitution in order to make way for the free trade agreement. A lot of people lost their land. They couldn't grow their food anymore. They couldn't feed their families. And the safety valve of Mexican society was to migrate to the United States. You know, millions and millions of Mexicans are found in the United States as a result of these unfair, savage laws that don't allow people to live in their own land or country. So anyway, the safety valve in Colombia will be the growing of coca, the coca leaf, the prime ingredient of cocaine. So Colombia is going to export a lot more cocaine to the United States, and with that, the Colombian military will launch more wars against the insurgencies who are funded by the narcotics trade, and also the paramilitary groups are also funded by the narcotics trade. But if you look at the Colombian map of the fumigations that are happening, the United States is with their military plan on Colombia, they give weapons and helicopters, and also Monsanto gives chemicals so that these airplanes can fumigate coca fields so they die, basically. So if the coca fields die, they have no income. They have no income, they're bound to reduce in size and numbers, right, theoretically. But where the fumigations are happening are where the insurgency is, and not the paramilitaries are. And when the fumigations happen, they fly at high altitudes. So the Monsanto chemical, it's like an ultra version of Roundup, which is sold in the U.S., but this one's more deadly, and the chemicals in it aren't fully listed. So they fumigate from really high altitudes, and it lands on people, They land on houses, on water streams, on legal crops like food. And people are losing their health, their sovereignty, their food security, everything.
You were talking about how people are getting displaced from their land, basically, and the struggle for land. Mm-hmm. We've seen over the years, just those of us who pay some attention, that there's millions of Colombians who are displaced within their own country. Can you talk about that?
Colombia has the largest population of refugees behind, I think, Sudan. Yeah, Sudan. There's about like 5.2 million, as some estimates go, of displaced people. And where the most displacements happen is where there is oil, gold, silver, emeralds, monocrops, and mining. So if you look at a map of Colombia and where all the mineral resources are concentrated, that is where you will find the most amount of people displaced. So the way that they are displaced is paramilitary groups who, I said earlier, work in conjunction with the Colombian military, kill people. They terrorize people, they massacre people in order for them to leave. They're scared, they're vulnerable, they don't want to stay there. You wouldn't want to stay in your neighborhood if 100 people in your block were killed, would you? So people leave. They migrate to other areas, they migrate to urban centers, they become beggars, become, you know, shoe shiners, they pick up garbage, they're basically homeless, most of them. And so the paramilitaries come in, they kill people, they massacre people, people leave. And it makes room for a multinational corporation to come in and use that land for extraction. Colombia is the biggest exporter of coal in Latin America, perhaps the world. 46% of the national territory of Colombia is either under license or being requested for license for mineral operations. Colombia receives a large amount of coal, especially to the southeast of the United States, and also to Europe. We have Drummond, which is operating here, MPX from Brazil, Glencore from Switzerland, AngloGold Ashanti, which is MIT's capital, they're all here. They're all displacing people off their land. They're all contaminating water resources. They're all contaminating the environment. Mining now is considered a public interest in Colombian law. And in 2000, the Canadian Foreign Affairs International Development Agency funded a lawyers group to assess the Colombian military to change its mining regulations to allow it to be the way it is now. Colombia now, with its mineral extraction processes from multinational corporations, does not even receive any economic benefit at all. People, you know, Colombian government says, you know, there's foreign investment being put in. But when you calculate the social and the environmental impact, Colombia is actually paying multinationals to come and extract the wealth of the land. And Colombians aren't getting any of it. And if they are, the Colombian state is taxing Colombians to fuel the armed conflict.
Colombia is a very rich land, which is what's leading to this, the selling off of the resources by the government to multinationals at a loss, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. I did also recently see a documentary that was about a place called La Toma in Cauca, where they actually did win the rights, at least for now, to do artisanal mining of gold, which is what they were doing in the face of it being taken over. And I did want to talk a little bit about the fact that it took some intervention. It took getting the U.S. Congress involved as well to shine a light on the human rights abuses there. If you can share any stories or, you know, details of how people can put that pressure on to support people's lives in those communities.
With the sugarcane cutters, they've had a lot of accompaniment from the U.S., from the U.S. Embassy, from activists. With the GM workers, they've had a lot of political solidarity from activists, from people in the U.S. These people have been applying pressure to the Colombian government, sending letters to the Ministry of Justice, sending letters to the judges, asking them to, you know, comply and be efficient. I think the best way to apply pressure to the Colombian government is applying pressure to senators and congresspeople in the United States, because they have a lot of leverage here in Colombia. Colombia listens to the United States, it's his biggest trading partner, economic partner, military partner. So if U.S. senators and congresspeople are worried, that sends off to them a red flag, like, hey, maybe we should stop this massacre, maybe we should stop this shooting, maybe we should protect trade union members. But it's really up to U.S. people to get informed and apply a lot of pressure. The free trade agreement, a lot of Colombian organizations have been very thankful that it didn't pass when it was proposed to pass, and I think in 2006 with George Bush.
Yeah.
And it took a really long time to pass, which is really good. But now the strategy has to focus into how do we, instead of how do we stop it, into how do we reduce the negative effects of it. But the best thing for Colombia right now is international solidarity and applying pressure to senators and congresspeople to pay attention to the human rights abuses that are happening in Colombia, that the U.S. is aggravating by having free trade agreements that dismantle labor protections, that dismantle Afro-Colombian communities, that dismantle indigenous people's rights. So I think that's the best way to apply pressure and asking your congressmen and senators to apply pressure to the Colombian government.
I think a lot of us are in a space where we feel like it doesn't make a difference when we apply pressure to these congresspeople, but they're real life examples of how it does make a difference in people's lives. It's in fact saved some people's lives and communities. So I guess we can't stress that enough.
Yeah, I mean, one story that I remember is that in Cauca, there were some peasants being held by paramilitary groups, and a delegation was present from Witness for Peace was present there, and they got in contact with some senators from the United States, and those senators called the Colombian, the U.S. Embassy here, and then the U.S. Embassy called the Colombian government. About an hour or so later, those peasants were let go by the paramilitary groups. 2 weeks ago, I received a call from one of our partners who lives in Cauca, and he called me desperately, and his wife was in the center of town. And what happened was the left-wing insurgency had tried to blow up a police station with a homemade mortar, like a little tank. And as a response, the Colombian military sent in two helicopters and started machine gunning the town. There was people, children, women, my friend's wife in the town, and people were getting rained on by bullets. This was an indiscriminate reaction or overreaction, right? So he calls me, and he says, you know, we got to do something about this. So I'm thinking, you know, calling the U.S. Embassy and telling them to, you know, tell the Colombian government to relax and have an action plan for the civilian population. So when I get in the phone call, so when I call Marilyn, which was in the center of town getting bombarded with bullets from U.S. helicopters and U.S. machine guns, I said, you know, what do you think we should do? Should we send a fax to the Colombian military? What should we do? And she said, please don't send a fax to the Colombian military because that means they will come to the center of town. And maybe you, in the U.S. mind, the presence of military or police is a comforting fact. But in Colombia, the presence of military means human rights abuses. So calling in even, you know, the military to stop the attack and sending in more troops to have more safety, it means human rights abuses to the civilian population. And in the 47 years of armed conflict, the people who have suffered the most in Colombia has been the civilian population, with millions and millions displaced, tortured, killed, or disappeared.
You're listening to Circle A Radio on KBOO 90.7 FM. Our guest tonight is Carlos Cruz. He works with Witness for Peace in Colombia.
Precioso y todo se lo llevó. Ladrón te fuiste, mi oro y me dejaste. Carlos, can you talk about the Afro-Colombian community and, you know, where folks are there and what is special about those communities and the rights they have or the rights of theirs that are being violated?
Yeah, so in 1993, the Colombian Constitution awarded the indigenous peoples of Colombia and Afro-descendants peoples of Colombia special rights, ancestral rights. And they, whenever a mega project that is wanted to happen in their land, they are given prior and free consultation. So the mega project or the multinational has to consult with those communities and ask if it can happen. This sounds great because it gives them protection, culture protection, because their land is their culture is their life. And if they don't have their land, they lose their life, their culture, their food, their family, their tradition, their roots, and become displaced. So now what's been happening is there's so many requests for mining and extraction in Colombia that the Colombian government isn't even fulfilling their constitutional right or obligations. They're not even consulting people. And if they do consult, it's very fast, it's very speedy. No one even notices it. No one even is aware of it. Or they choose a leader in the community that's been co-opted by the multinational corporation, which has been happening in La Guajira up north with coal or with MPX. People get flights to Brazil. They get a tour of the corporation in Brazil, and people are happy with it. And, of course, they're going to say, okay, you can mine here because they think they're socially responsible, but they're not. So what's been happening is a lot of the wealth is in Afro-Colombian territory. So these multinationals are coming in. There's no consultation that is real or effective, or that no one from the Afro-Colombian would even consider consultation. Yeah, they're getting their land taken, even though there's protections against, or the protections for Afro-Colombian indigenous people. And also the victims' laws sounds great, but it was also enacted without consultation of Afro-Colombians, because they are the most affected by the conflict. So in order to have a law for a victim without consulting the victim is re-victimizing that victim. And it's losing out on the opportunity to have true and meaningful solution to a problem. And this is what's happening now.
You're talking about indigenous communities as well. I wanted to hear about some of what's going on. I've heard that there are communities that are somewhat autonomous and have their own security forces and actually have been really active in resisting neoliberal policies and the FTAs. So can you talk with us about that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, Colombia has 1.5% of its population is indigenous. Even though it's a small percentage of indigenous peoples, they have such an amazing, well-organized, powerful movement against neoliberal policies that are affecting their land, their culture, and their dignity. So the CRIC, which is like the Northern Council of Indigenous Peoples of Cauca, which is a state here in Colombia, or the ASIN, the Association of Indigenous Councils, they are very strong and well-organized, and they mostly operate in the south of the country where the more indigenous peoples are. And what happens with them is their land is also in mega projects, targets. Agricultural laws, like with the free trade agreement, will make, you know, growing their food less viable. They do have autonomous institutions, like, you know, they have their own education systems, their own health systems, they have indigenous reserves. But these indigenous reserves are being violated because the Colombian military comes in, paramilitary groups comes in, the left-wing insurgency comes in. So they want, indigenous peoples of Colombia want autonomy of their land, their culture, their dignity, their life. But this stands in the way of armed actors, illegal or legal. Because legal or illegal armed actors want control of the land and the people. They want to have you follow their orders. They want to have your land. And indigenous peoples in Colombia don't want that. So what they've done as a response, a peaceful response, they've founded Indigenous Guard. That's basically conformed of people from indigenous communities who are chosen by the communities because all the processes in indigenous communities take place with consultation of the community. People aren't just appointed or self-elected. So there's thousands of them, and what they do is their strength is in unity. And if something happens to one of them, perhaps, for example, you know, you'll get a response from 10,000 people. So the Indigenous Guard maintains control over Indigenous land so that armed actors or unarmed actors don't enter that territory, but in a peaceful way. So they have a very peaceful solution to a very, very violent context. And it's quite amazing what they're doing.
Yeah, it is. That's great to hear about. Actually, all of the people who are consistently organizing for their communities and for their rights, it's really inspiring because, as you talk about, the stakes are really high in Colombia. What about student organizing? What have been their demands and what are they facing right now?
The Colombian government wanted to propose a law called Law 30, which was a privatization of education. And with the free trade agreement, it was kind of like the cherry on top. So what happened was Colombian students mobilized by the thousands and thousands for about a month and a half or two. They shut down the schooling system, the National University, one of the biggest in Colombia, which I live next to. It was on strike. Students were out in the streets peacefully, demonstrating, marching in the daytime, in the nighttime. And with their organizing, they managed to stop the privatization of schooling. And one of their biggest complaints or grievances was that we don't want to study 4 years at a university and pay for it 15 years, which is the U.S. model of indebtedness. Under the privatization model of Colombia, they wanted students to take out loans to pay for their schooling. And in Colombia, this is silly because the best and biggest university is free. You might pay maybe, you know, like $10 or $15 a semester, but it's technically free. And to have that free, awesome education be privatized to cost them a lot more money and to pay for it for 15 years, to the Colombian mind, it was ridiculous. So parents, students, workers, they all mobilized and they stopped it because a country that cannot afford education is a country that is easy to exploit. And in Colombia, this exploitation is happening by multinational corporations. So the stakes were very high in this one, and the student movement was very well organized, very successful. And they're not stopping there either. They're joining with other sectors of Colombian society to get strength and stand behind them in solidarity to also defeat other mega projects, other neoliberal projects, and other neoliberal reforms that the Colombian government wants to enact.
That's an exciting victory, and I'm sure it will speak to a lot of us here who are struggling with that ballooning debt of having decided to go to university. And
yeah, I think the U.S. student debt levels are at their highest in history.
Yeah, this is, you know, an area definitely ripe for organizing here in the U.S. Speaking of the organizing in the U.S., what is coming through to Colombia from this most recent uprising of people occupying spaces in the United States?
The Colombian people have been very responsive to the Occupy movement or the anti-Wall Street movement, even though they're not out in tents like they were back in the summer. Colombian society knows that the movement is still happening in people's heads. Maybe not physically, but it's the movement is in people's heads, and maybe once it gets warmer, you know, people will go out again. but it's very good to see a very unequal society and a very sometimes blind society go to the streets and form a movement. For other people, it means a lot because if the U.S. system changes and its inequality changes internally, there's hope for it to change its inequalities externally.
You know, there's movements that have been happening for a very, very long time here that are excited to see more folks come out into the streets as well.
Yeah.
in the period of the 1960s and the 1970s, we saw a lot of repression with the COINTEL programs, where people were imprisoned and some people were even murdered, and never on the level that Colombia's experienced that national trauma of all the murders. But now we're seeing different types of anti-terrorism laws come out and a lot of harassment of communities like the Muslim communities and so on. Mm-hmm. What does Colombia have on the books as far as anti-terror laws?
Well, they've been living with an internationally recognized terrorist organization for the last 47 years. But in 2000, Álvaro Uribe, the last president of Colombia, enacted the Democratic Security Plan, which was basically to minimize the terrorists, quote-unquote, of the FARC. And he pumped the country full of military, helicopters, and in some ways, you know, their numbers have decreased, but at the cost of human rights abuses, at the cost of repression. NGOs were, you know, monitored. They were spied on by the Colombian version of the FBI. There were so many disappearances. But yeah, I mean, the same thing is happening in Colombia, where civil liberties don't mean anything to the Colombian military, the police, or the state. But yeah, the same thing is happening in Colombia, but it's more visible in Colombia where people are getting killed. But maybe in the U.S. it's a bit less visible.
Yeah, it seems like there's leaders in Colombia who speak about the repression and even about the danger that their lives are in. And many of those same people were murdered by the government and paramilitaries. But I've heard a lot of people speak in a way where they are going to continue on that struggle and know that other people will take their place, which is a level of overcoming repression that's really, it's hard for people here to imagine.
Yeah. I mean, I think in the U.S., you're seeing a lot more mobilization as there's a financial crisis, there's less jobs, less, you know, security or stability for American society. You have to keep in mind that in Latin America, we've had our economic crises for decades now. I mean, the 1980s was called the last decade. We didn't produce any growth at all. We were stuck in recession and inflation. The 1990s was our neoliberal decade, where we sold all our resources and our riches to the world abroad. And so for Latin American societies, I think, we know what's at stake, and we know what an economic crisis is, and we know what a political crisis is. We've had dictatorships, repressions, coup d'etats. So there's a lot more organizing, and because people understand what happens if they don't. In the U.S., this is maybe the first economic crisis that people remember, at least in my generation. But yeah, I mean, Latin America has been living with economic crises for decades now.
Are there resources that you'd recommend to folks to continue to educate themselves about Colombia and Latin America?
Yeah, the Washington Office on Latin America has really good resources on all of Latin American countries. One thing I would pay attention to from a U.S. citizenry standpoint is the drug war that is happening now in Mexico, in Central America, and also in Colombia. I mean, the U.S. is the biggest consumer of narcotics of Latin America, and Colombia, one of the biggest producers of Latin America. And it's turned, this consumption habit has turned Colombia, Central America, and Mexico into a war zone, and the U.S. streets into prisons and ghettos and, you know, cesspool of social inequality. I think they've been working on that topic quite a lot. Washington Office in Latin America, if you read Spanish, I would read La Jornada. It's a Mexican newspaper. Human Rights Watch is always good. They always monitor the human rights situation in Colombia.
And I think you gave a really good in a nutshell about the drug war. If you have anything else you want to add on that, certainly go for it.
The drug war right now in Mexico is being used like internal conflict here in Colombia. When people get killed here, they say, oh, he was just a terrorist. He was a left-wing insurgency member. Let's not investigate. Let's not prosecute. In Mexico, the same thing is happening, except human rights defenders are getting killed. Activists are getting killed. Church leaders are getting killed. And they say, oh, he was just a narco trafficker. Let's not investigate. And there's an impunity rate that's very high. There's like how many has been dead? 40,000 since 2006, since Calderon took office. So The drug war in Colombia and Mexico are just the guys. One of the tools to hide the repression against people who are opposed to the neoliberal project, who oppose the drug wars, and who want to change the political systems in each country for the better. But like I said, the drug war is being used to silence them and to repress them.
And it really has to change the way even when people read mainstream news, they see that news, because oftentimes the program is to kill people who are rising up against those oppressions, who are mostly small farmers and, you know, regular folks, and even put weapons on them or put boots on them to make them look like they're some kind of a paramilitary or a narco trafficker or something that they're not.
Yeah, there was a huge scandal here in Colombia in 2006, I believe, called False Positives, where the Colombian military dressed innocent civilians as, insurgency to show results to the U.S. government that they're using their funds from Plan Colombia adequately.
It sounds like it was exposed then. Did anything come of that?
A lot more things could come out of it. If the Colombian government did not just approve granting judicial protection against the military. In other countries, the military is tried in civilian courts when there's human rights abuses. But in Colombia now, they just gave more protection, legal protection, to the military. So if you commit a human rights abuse, like in this case of the false positives, you should be tried in a civilian court because you killed a civilian. It was not a war. It was not a conflict. They were not shooting. It was a civilian death, which a civilian is more likely to give justice out because it has no institutional ties. Whereas the military, these are military judges, military lawyers, in a military court, in a military institution, judging other military people. So, and the impunity rate under these circumstances is quite extraordinary, as you can imagine. And Colombia just gave their military more protection, which will make human rights abuses in Colombia even more abused and grave and less respected.
Well, we have talked about a lot of things. I'm wondering if there's something that you wanted to get out to our listening audience that we haven't touched upon today.
Yeah, I mean, maybe, you know, Colombia is a faraway country to most people, but we live in a globalized economy with globalized effects and repercussions. And our communities are seeing more and more Hispanic migrants from Central America, from Mexico, from South America, and it's for a reason. There's crises here, there's wars here, there's free trade agreements here. And I think that the U.S. needs to be aware of that and receive these people like economic migrants, because most of them are, and not as like a threat to, you know, the economy or the world, or, you know, stop criminalizing the migrants and receive them like regular people. And I think these histories, these stories, these news that are happening can give a lot of light to that context.
Great. Would you like us to give out information for Witness for Peace as well?
Sure. People can always come on a delegation to Mexico, Cuba, Nicaragua, or Colombia. And we go into these zones, and we meet with the people here. And, if you want to learn about these issues, a delegation is a great way to do it. And then also getting connected with other people who are active on these subjects, who have also experienced the delegation, to try and change U.S. foreign policy towards the better.
No le copio, hombre que habla más de la cuello, no le copio. Niña que ya se cerruchan, dice shh, no le copiaré. Que vienen las mujeres chimosas, no le copio, hombre que habla más de la cuello, no le copio. Niña que ya se cerruchan, dice shh, no le copiaré.
You've been listening to Circle A Radio on your community radio station KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Locally, you can get involved with the Portland Central America Solidarity Committee. PCASC educates and mobilizes the community, workers, and students in the fight for human rights and social justice in the Americas. PCASC meetings take place the first and third Wednesday of every month from 7 to 9 p.m. at 2249 East Burnside Street. for organizing opposed to the next big trade agreement on the horizon, you can get in touch with the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign at 503-736-9777. They are organizing a community forum on the Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement for Wednesday, February 15th. And you can find more information on Witness for Peace at their website. Circle A Radio is on the first and third Wednesday of every month from 6 till 7 p.m. on KBOO Community Radio. We love to hear your feedback. CircleARadio@gmail.com. Music on tonight's show by Colombian hip-hop group Choquibtown. Choquib Town. Check them out. Thanks for listening.
Yo lo me como ese pecado, así sea del Yeah.